Welcome back to Teaching Matters, the University of Edinburgh's hub for discussing, promoting, and showcasing teaching and learning across the university. We're a website, blog, podcast, and most importantly, a small group of people passionate about providing platforms for conversations surrounding teaching and learning. I'm Sylvia, second-year PhD student and an intern at Teaching Matters, and I'll be walking you through this presentation. In the previous episode of this series, Irene shared with us her experiences with generative AI technologies. She brought a fresh student perspective to this ongoing conversation. To continue with that, in today's episode, we have Lara Dalmolin, a PhD student with us. Lara talks about some of the hidden and unspoken issues of AI technologies. With Irene asking her questions, Lara shares her thoughts on the digital divide, hidden labor, and most importantly, some of the harmful biases that generative AI might enhance. Let's hear from Lara now.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lara Dalmolin. I am a second-year PhD student in Science, Technology, and Innovation Studies at the University of Edinburgh. Also part of the social data science research cluster with the University of Copenhagen as well. And my research interests are within the realm and intersection of language, AI, and gender. So how all these things come together and interplay. And my research project specifically is about trying to integrate intersectional and especially queer perspectives in large language models.
Hello, everyone. First of all, thank you, Lara, for joining this podcast. So, what is the impact of ChatGPT on digital divide?
Thank you so much, Irene, for this fantastic as well as really difficult question. Perhaps before we get into this question, then, it could be useful to define for our listeners what is digital divide? And I think that's a remarkably difficult question to answer. Okay, so I think one way in which we can imagine the digital divide, at least in my head, is this sort of knowledge discrepancy, perhaps, in skills, in understanding, and in also education concerning some kinds of technology. And it can be usually, I think, is kind of enforced by larger circumstances, which can be access or availability of a certain technology. So, for example, the internet, some countries have more access to than others. Phones are the same. Phones require money to buy them. This can be another sort of element to consider within the digital divide. And I think it's a kind of question that it's really tempting to answer with it's good or it's bad. But I think that after all of our discussions about generative AI so far, we're starting to understand that AI technology isn't all that simple, really. So I kind of wanted to consider both arguments in relation to the digital divide here. So I think on one hand, generative AI provides a considerably wide section of the population with the opportunity to interact with AI for the first time in history, really. This is unprecedented, and it presents probably a large potential for AI literacy and outreach in general. So this potentially reduces the digital divide. But obviously here, I'm using the word potential and potentially. Why am I doing that? I think that's because on the other hand, we are kind of witnessing the largest round of technology testing without consent in the history of humanity, really. In so many countries, GPTs and generative AI technologies were just thrown on the web without use cases, without guidelines, without regulations for use, and most importantly, without a transparent way of operating. And so communities and institutions and companies and governments and people were just sort of left on their own to figure out how these technologies worked. And so this becomes a potentially enhancing mechanism for the digital divide when we start considering these knowledge discrepancies that there may be between companies and people and governments. And I think these become even more apparent when we start asking some questions such as, who does this technology benefit? And who does this knowledge benefit? And how does this work? And how much data is saved and lost? And what are the implications of these interactions? So I think there is a high potential for both. And it will ultimately be the use that we will decide and we will pick in the long term that will determine which kind of future will develop in terms of digital divide.
Yes, and thank you for your wonderful explanation for the first question. And you mentioned that there are different levels of infrastructure that can maybe lead to the digital divide. And you also mentioned that in some countries, there are not enough guidelines for how to use these technologies. So besides the infrastructure, what are the skills required for the use of ChatGPT? And how do you think these skills will impact digital divide?
Thank you so much, Irene. So I think using GPTs and generative AI in general definitely, absolutely requires some skills. And the practice of finding the most appropriate input or prompt for a GPT technology to allow this technology to solve a task is called prompt engineering. And for those of us who remember some perhaps slightly traumatic notions from high school maths, this essentially involves finding a function. And prompt engineering is a discipline that is evolving and developing really fast, and it presents some prolific as well as early research efforts, but it's becoming really prevalent both in computer science and in the social sciences and in academia as well. This practice, interestingly, is also becoming a job, a real job. So, for example, a mid-level prompt engineer in the Bay Area is paid somewhere between $150,000 and $300,000 a year, which is a very, very tempting salary. So to go back to your question, how does one develop this new skill, and how can this impact this digital divide, right? So I think I'm not aware of any university level course on prompt engineering so far. So the only way in which people could have got familiar with this technique up until this moment is by interacting directly with AI tools themselves. And while the use of, for instance, ChatGPT is not particularly regulated in a lot of countries, so people can just access it, previous versions of the model, as well as comparable models that are available out there, require the purchase of prompting credits, as well as some kind of identity verification. So we can really say that individuals that have had the opportunity to develop the skill of prompt engineering so far definitely have had some kind of privilege. And I think that we can see how that feeds in directly on arguments on the digital divide.
Thank you, Lara. As you mentioned before, students are usually learning some skills from the interactions with this AI software. And now we kind of move from digital divide to the gender bias. So during the interactions, the previous GPTs were accused of demonstrating gender bias, kind of like reinforce the existing stereotypes. Now in your research, do you think ChatGPT has the gender bias, or the gender bias has been improved?
Well, I think this is the kind of topic where I could spend hours and hours talking about. So for this purpose, I have prepared 2 points for you, because I just wanted to give sort of a short answer and give us perhaps some food for thought for the next conversations, if we will have some. So the first point that I would like to offer here is that there are multiple experiments with ChatGPT in this case, which is GPT 3.5 and even GPT 4, showing considerable levels of gender bias as well as intersectional bias. So this is some physical, empirical data that we have. This is not a secret. Large companies are aware of this. This issue exists. So the crucial questions to consider here are, how harmful is this bias? Where does it appear? So which identities does it affect the most? And how does this bias manifest once the model is deployed in the real world? These are obviously really difficult questions to answer and definitely require some long-term institutional research efforts. So this is a small introduction that I wanted to give here about this bias. This exists and it will require many efforts to resolve. The second point that I would like to give here was to kind of go back to your question, Irene. Well, if this is the case, why does ChatGPT or the research team behind it kind of claim that this is a fairer model compared to its predecessors and competitors, right? And I think this is for two reasons. The first is because ChatGPT actually blocked or somehow regulated the insertion of prompts that are somehow harmful according to some internal criteria that we're not, it has not been directly disclosed. We're not too aware about this. While this on one hand does not allow the model to produce potentially toxic content, on the other hand, it also kind of hinders research efforts to understand and investigate the full potential and capability of these technologies. So we go back to the double-edged sword concept that Irene, you and Vasilis mentioned. And secondly, another reason why the company may be making this claim is because the data set on which ChatGPT, so GPT 3.5, was trained contains many more examples of harmful content that the model should avoid. So it has many more examples to sort of understand what this harmful content is. And I think I might slightly anticipate something that I probably guess you would like to ask in a little bit, but the trick here is that someone had to label that content. Somebody, some human had to say that that content was harmful in the first place. And a really interesting article by someone called Billy Perigo on the Times magazine actually suggests that this labor had been outsourced to Kenya. And Kenyan workers had to read for about 9 hours a day instances of toxic content and label them as such for about $2 per hour. So while the result of this labor can be somehow appreciable in the model, because the model really physically has slightly less instances of this toxic content, the model itself is far from ethical because of the way in which it was built. So there is this sort of terrible, really sad irony here. So maybe I anticipated a question from you here, but I thought I could tie in straight away also to save a little bit of time, perhaps.
Yeah, and that's excellent. Thank you, Lara. And you covered a lot of points from gender bias to the hidden labor. So I want to ask you here, do you think, is there a better way to both balance the company's development and reduce the exploitation of hidden workers, as you mentioned before?
Yeah, I think there are ways to achieve this, but as with any really good solution, there is no easy solution to a hard problem. And this is, in fact, what I'm kind of exploring in my own research here at the University of Edinburgh. How can we sort of carry forward these models into our future and into our work without exploiting people? Because that's, you know, really what we've talked about with hidden labor. And I think to some extent that involves involving users directly in technology design processes. And users or data workers need to be adequately paid for their working conditions. And not just that, their labor needs to be recognized. Also, by keeping in mind that when we start to add, let's say, minoritized communities within data processes, the visibility that this process comes with may or may not harm them. So the people whose perspectives actually need this work the most may be harmed by this work itself. So these are obviously very difficult problems, and I think a solution can only be found really by having an open and honest conversation with all stakeholders involved. And I will not pretend that I can answer fully this question for you right now. But if I can, I wanted to quickly offer one additional thought to sort of tie this back to academia to wrap up this section. I think maybe in a slightly overly optimistic way, the introduction of generative technologies within labor and education may be highlighting some long-standing issues within these fields. These issues existed already. The fact that students are overwhelmed, the fact that there is hidden labor in our workforce and supply chain of labor. So maybe this is finally a time in which we can address some of these issues comprehensively and once and for all, maybe with the help of this technology, maybe not. That will be up to us. But one way in which I am planning myself to start the academic year with my students is to sort of highlight the fact that this tool is there. They can use it if they want, but the focus now should shift on their own relationship, their students' relationships with the content. So what does it mean for them? And I think this is something that generative AI, it cannot answer that question. So perhaps this is a way in which we can start considering all of these identities and diversity that we have in our students and workforce and establishing a healthy relationship between them and the technology. I just wanted to add that at the end. So yeah, thank you so much, Irene, for your wonderful questions.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teaching Matters. Teaching Matters is brought to you by the University of Edinburgh's Institute of Academic Development. For more posts and conversations about teaching and learning, head to our blog. We'd be delighted for you to join these conversations. To do so, just email us, teachingmatters@ed.ac.uk. You can also find us on Twitter. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts. I'm leaving a 5-star review. Music for this episode was provided by Hook Sounds. In the meantime, stay curious.